From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. As fires continue to burn along the West Coast, releasing a trail of smoke that has reached Europe, people in communities destroyed by fires are getting a glimpse at the wreckage. One of those communities is the city of Phoenix, Oregon, just north of the California border. At least three people died in the area and around 2,000 structures destroyed. Stuart Warren is a city council member there today. He's been running a supply center for people displaced. He is on Skype. Stuart, we're so sorry to hear about what happened to your city. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes for us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, and thanks for covering this important event.
Well, and there are still restrictions on entering Phoenix, but what can you tell us about what it looks like right now?
It's a pretty amazing event. You know, the fire was so dramatic that nearly every structure that it touched is burnt to the ground. You don't see many structures that are partially burnt, and it burnt pockets throughout both Talent and Phoenix, leaving some neighborhoods completely intact. Then other areas, it looks like a bomb has gone off. I saw wheels of a car that were melted off the car.
Well, and I understand that you were out fly fishing. You're a guide the day of the fire, and you had to evacuate without even going home. So it must have been very quick.
Yes. The evacuation notices came to me within a period of maybe 30 minutes, you know, level one to level three. And so, yeah, out on the river, and I noticed another fire started, the Obachain fire. I saw its plume go up, and it was relatively close to where we were right when I got my level three evacuation notice. So I loaded up my customers in the boat and rowed as fast as I could row off the river, put the boat on the trailer and dropped my customers off and tried to run home to try to save my dog. But luckily she's pretty smart and was able to get herself out of the fence. And then a lovely young woman took her in.
So she's okay.
Yep. She's happy and healthy with my mom right now.
And your home also was not destroyed, which must be a huge relief. But other people near you, not so fortunate. What are you hearing from your neighbors?
Well, yeah, I've talked to many of my neighbors. You know, I called many of them once I was able to tour the damage and make sure that they are aware of their losses. My home was not damaged, but I did lose my garage. That's how close the fire came to my house. But my immediate neighbor, her home is fine. But then the neighbor behind them, who's a good friend of mine, just absolutely everything's gone. Everyone else surrounding me, their homes are completely unscathed.
So you're trying to get supplies now to people who need them. What do people need right now in Phoenix and Talent, Oregon?
The needs are changing on a daily basis. People are starting to kind of figure out that this isn't just going to be a 1 week or 2 week experience. They're starting to think longer term now. So they're coming by for shampoos and makeup and food and dog food and toys for their children. I think most people right now need money. This fire has really impacted many migrant worker populations, as well as many low income individuals. The Latinx community has been severely impacted by this. Most of our mobile home parks housed a number of low income folks. So they unfortunately don't have access to insurance. Most insurance companies won't cover those structures, or if they do cover them, the coverage is very low. So most of them are kind of out on the streets right now with nothing. And they don't have savings for the most part. They don't have family here. I heard a story yesterday from a member of the Talent Phoenix School District, where they found 18 of their students living in one home out in a little town called White City.
And I imagine that the toll emotionally on people is just unimaginable right now. People must be in shock.
Yeah, it's definitely true. You know, I think there's a period of kind of numbness where you're in disbelief, and then you start to talk to other people and, you know, recognize the devastation that's occurred. And I think people are starting to grieve now. I must say that yesterday or the day before was the first day I saw people smiling again, which was good.
Do you think that Phoenix will ever recover?
Yes, definitely. We are lucky enough to have a community here that is just unbelievably strong. And we're just getting an extreme amount of support from our surrounding communities and worldwide at this point as well. So yeah, we will rebuild. It may take us a few years, maybe even up to as many as 10 years to get things back to where they were before the fire. But we are working as hard as we can through so many different organizations and agencies right now that we will rebuild, absolutely.
That is Stuart Warren, a city council member in Phoenix, Oregon, much of which was destroyed in a wildfire last week. Stuart Warren, thank you so much for joining us and best of luck in the recovery there.
Thank you for having me, and I appreciate you all covering this important event.
The mother of Breonna Taylor says she hopes a $12 million settlement with the city of Louisville, Kentucky will be the first step in getting justice for her daughter's death. Breonna Taylor was shot and killed by police in her apartment last March. And along with the monetary settlement, Louisville has agreed to implement a series of police reforms. But our next guest says, historically, payouts do not always equate to significant changes within law enforcement. Joanna Schwartz is a University of California, Los Angeles law professor and joins us now with more. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
The family of Breonna Taylor now wants to see charges filed against the officers involved in her daughter's death. In your examination of police settlements, do monetary payouts actually lead to charges or more systemic change?
I think that lawsuit settlements do not translate into criminal charges. They are really separate processes and decided by different people. I think that the question of how monetary awards translate into police department changes is a complicated question. I think that if you simply assume that payouts are going to deter in the future, you are going to be disappointed because it doesn't necessarily work that way. But making lawsuit payouts can create pressures, political pressures on police departments to make changes in the future.
You know, one criticism of settlements like this case is it's being paid by taxpayers, not the police. And it's true that police lawsuits can actually be very expensive for cities and citizens. New York City, for instance, paid a record $302 million for police misconduct lawsuits in 2017. You've actually advocated that cities and police should create a hybrid type model in which officers do have to contribute to these settlements. Why do you think this model would be more effective?
Lawsuit payouts are expensive, but they are a drop in the bucket for most cities. I think that police officers should sometimes be required to contribute something to the resolution of settlements and judgments that are entered against them, because I do think that we need to find ways to sharpen the deterrent effect of these lawsuits. In many cases, not cases necessarily that receive the kind of press attention that Breonna Taylor's case has received, but in the run-of-the-mill case, the lawsuit will be defended by the city attorney. The money will be paid out of general funds, and little to no effort will be made by the police department to learn from the lawsuit, the facts that came out in the case, and the allegations in the case to try to prevent those things from happening in the future. There won't be employment consequences for the officer that result from the lawsuit itself. And so I think that if we are going to try to have civil rights litigation achieve its intended goals of both compensating people whose rights have been violated and deterring future misconduct, we need to make sure that plaintiffs are truly getting paid when their rights are violated. It also, I do think, means that the payments still should come primarily from central government funds. But I also think that we need to think in creative ways about how to sharpen the deterrent effect of these suits, because right now in too many parts of the country, they are simply being treated as the cost of doing business, and there are inadequate efforts made to reflect on these cases and think about how to prevent these things from happening in the future.
Breonna Taylor's settlement is somewhat unique in that it also comes with a series of police reforms, like creating a housing credit so that officers can actually live in communities they patrol, and procedural changes like clarifying chains of command with search warrants. How often do these reforms actually get implemented?
What Breonna Taylor's family has on their side in this effort is public attention, national attention, international attention on this case and on the resolution of this case. And although I'm unaware of any formal mechanisms in the settlement agreement to ensure that these changes are made, I also know that the world is watching. And that means that if the department does not make these changes, people will know and will continue to press for those changes to be made.
That's UCLA law professor Joanna Schwartz. Thank you so much.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Today, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden is talking about how to equitably distribute a COVID-19 vaccine, while President Trump is helping to raise money for House Republicans ahead of the election. Last night in an ABC town hall with undecided voters, the president said a vaccine could be 3 or 4 weeks away, and he denied downplaying the coronavirus, even though that's what he told journalist Bob Woodward he was doing.
Well, I didn't downplay it. I actually, in many ways, I upplayed it in terms of action. My action was very strong.
Yourself,
yeah, because what I did was with China, I put a ban on. With Europe, I put a ban on.
Our political strategist join us now, Matt Mikowiak, Republican. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
And Jamal Simmons, the Democrat. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. So let's start with that ABC town hall last night. President Trump once again suggested the virus would just disappear. He said masks were of questionable use in stopping the spread, and he had no regrets about his handling of the pandemic. Matt, obviously, all those three things I just mentioned are not an effective way to stop the spread of coronavirus. But is it effective for him politically? Why does he keep saying these things?
Well, I mean, as it relates to the Woodward revelation, I think there's a couple points that really need to be considered. I think the first is, the World Health Organization didn't declare a global pandemic for COVID until, I think, March 13th. Is that because they were downplaying it? Is that because they weren't taking it seriously? Is that because they wanted to risk, lives around the world? No. It's because there was a real concern in those early days, particularly in mid to late February, that there could be a run on PPE, that global supply chains could be impacted, that hospitals could potentially be overrun. So I think there was some legitimate concern there. And so the president chose instead, I think, from a public standpoint, to urge calm as he stood up the task force, as he started to take decisive actions. So I think the point he was trying to make in the town hall is he took very serious actions, but he tried to urge calm in public statements during that period of time.
Jamal, it was interesting to see the president take questions from regular people in the crowd. That's something we haven't seen him do. Some of them even voted for Hillary Clinton last time around. Here is a black pastor, Carl Day, who asked Trump to say more about racism in the U.S. beyond saying that some police officers choke under pressure and kill black people with excessive force. Listen.
And I mean, you've said everything else about choking and everything else, but you have yet to address and acknowledge that there's been a race problem in America.
So if you go, well, I hope there's not a race problem. I can tell you there's none with me, because I have great respect for all races, for everybody. This country is great because of it.
Jamal, how did that moment resonate for you?
Well, the president of the United States is trying not to talk about something that is a real challenge for him, because so many of his supporters are people who are invested in his, let's just call it what it is, in some of his racist policies. I mean, look at what he did to children at the border who were separated from their parents. Could you imagine if there were white children from Norway who were taken from their children? It didn't matter, because there were Latino children in the Southwest where that occurred. Charlottesville, which is why Joe Biden got into the race to begin with, because he said there were good people on both sides. The president has a history of this kind of rhetoric. So when he's confronted with it, what we know about Donald Trump is that he'll say whatever it takes at any given moment to try to get out of a problem. And just to go back quickly to what Matt just said, if the president didn't want to take on a coronavirus in public and not get people ramped up and upset, he should have been taking it on more in private. We didn't see him picking up PPE. We didn't see him getting the work done on getting some of the ventilators taken care of that needed to. That stuff didn't happen for weeks after. The president is trying to come up with an excuse now to fix the problem he created in the beginning of this year.
Matt, what about the president's performance in general last night? We've got the debates coming up in less than 2 weeks. Now, what did you think of how he did?
Yeah, look, it was a more hostile environment, I think, than number one, than he's used to, and probably more hostile than most presidents, you know, are used to. So I think from that standpoint, it's probably pretty good practice for him, because I imagine the debates are going to be that way as well. And if he hasn't had that kind of experience recently, he needs to you know, start to figure out how to handle these situations. Look, I thought substantively, for the most part, I thought it was fine. He's going to have to explain what the government did on COVID and why it was sufficient and how we're going to get past it. And he's been talking about Operation Warp Speed quite a bit. And the signs are encouraging right now in terms of positivity rates, in terms of transmission, in terms of hospitalization rate, all of those things, death rate, all those things have come down in the last, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. But I think the bigger point is, you know, does he have an opportunity to make this a referendum, not on himself, but a referendum on the economic vision for the future? Who can rebuild the American economy? And I think as the electorate has turned its attention a little bit away from COVID and towards crime in our cities and towards the economy, that's why Trump has been gaining. And that's why I think this is a very competitive race right now.
Jamal, Biden has been a little rocky in the debates along the way. Are you worried about how he'll do when he faces Trump one-on-one?
You know, when Joe Biden gets to the microphone, everybody holds their breath a little bit because you just don't know what might happen. But nowhere near, at least the one thing you know about Joe Biden is that he's trying to tell the truth. The thing about Donald Trump when he gets to the microphone is that, again, he'll just say whatever it takes to try to get through the moment, whether it's true or not. And repeatedly, we come out book after book, journalist after journalist, ex-staffer after ex-staffer, and we find out that that what's going on in the Trump White House is just a circus. And he's the head ringleader. I think we've got to keep all that in mind when we go and look at these debates, because the president does not have a history of leveling with the American people, and we've got to decide whether or not we want to keep that going for 4 years.
We talked a little bit about Latino voters, but let's focus on that specifically, because Biden spoke with Latino voters on his first official visit to Florida as the Democratic presidential candidate this week. Listen.
Look, Donald Trump has failed the Hispanic community time and time again, and that's not a secret. Whether it's in his heinous act of separating children from their families at our border, or his repeated attacks on Dreamers, or his neglect of the people of Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, or his repeated failure to make sure essential workers have the personal protective equipment they need.
Jamal, should Biden be worried about recent polls that show his support among Latinos in Florida is not as strong as Hillary Clinton's and she lost Florida?
He should certainly be worried about any polls that show that things aren't that great. I think what's happening, though, he addressed some of this. He was in Florida this week, and he, you know, particularly in Kissimmee, which is Osceola County, it's right in the center of the state. And that part, Orlando, Orange County, there are about 1 million-plus Puerto Rican Americans who are in that part of the state. They're a big chunk of the electorate in Florida. And, you know, one of the things he talked to them about was about what's happening with the president, what he said about military veterans and people dying for their country being suckers and losers. Remember, there were 3,100 Army recruits from Central and Southwest Florida, 750 of them a year from Orlando. He's talking about veterans issues to that community because in addition to immigration, in addition to the coronavirus and these questions that they have about President Trump, they also are very seriously veteran and military-minded patriots.
Mm-hmm. Matt, obviously a big reason for Trump's support among Latinos in Florida is sort of anti-socialist sentiment from Cuban Americans and Venezuelan Americans especially. But Joe Biden is not a socialist. Is that going to be enough to give Trump the edge with Latino voters?
Yeah, he does seem to be in stronger position in Florida because of that difference in the Hispanic population. And look, Florida, it gives Biden an opportunity to end the election, you know, at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock on election night. If he were to win Florida by a couple points and that call was made, Trump would have no path. And that's why I think you're seeing Michael Bloomberg invest something like $100 million to try to help Biden win Florida. I do believe Trump's going to win Florida. I think that he is going to have a higher margin among Hispanics. You are correct when voters in Florida look at Joe Biden, I'm sure they don't probably see a sort of Castro type figure. But the question is, you know, does the Democratic Party agenda, does it sort of have a comparison to the direction that those countries went by taking over private sector aspects of the economy, by giving free health care out, those kinds of steps. And so we'll see. I mean, Florida is going to be crucial. If Trump wins Florida, mm-hmm. He's got, three or four narrow but certain pathways to 270 electoral votes. Without Florida, it's going to be over and it's going to be an early night. Mm-hmm. But I do think Trump's going to narrowly win Florida.
Just finally want to ask about one of the Senate races a lot of people are watching in South Carolina. This is Lindsey Graham's Senate seat, and he's up against Jamie Harrison. He's been hammering his opponent to turn over his tax returns. Listen.
I've released 11 years of my tax returns. Where are your tax returns? How did you make your money?
Well, so then yesterday, Harrison released them and tweeted, "Done, now do Trump." Jamal, do you think that they can oust Lindsey Graham, the Democrats can, in this race?
Beating Lindsey Graham is a very uphill fight. When I was in South Carolina talking to Jamie Harrison just a few months ago, he was getting a lot of people from around the state, not Democrats, who were showing up at his events, not because they supported him, but they wanted to check him out. I think the door is open for people in South Carolina to pick another candidate. Picking a Democrat is a tough hill to climb for anybody. But I think Jamie Harrison could do it. The question is whether or not people want somebody who's just going to go to Washington and co-sign everything Donald Trump does, or they want an independent mind who's just going to look out for South Carolinians. And that seems to be the question on the table down there.
Matt, just briefly, you think that Lindsey Graham can hold on?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would wager pretty much everything I have. I mean, if the Democrats flip South Carolina, they're gonna win 8 or 10 or 12 Senate seats. That seat is not in play. The Democrats aren't really, doing much there. Harrison has raised significant money, and he deserves credit for kind of creating something out of nothing. But no, Lindsey Graham's going to win. Trump's going to win South Carolina by a pretty large margin. You just can't overcome a 10 or 12 or 15 point margin.
Well, except that in the polls in that race, the public polls anyway, in that race, it looks pretty close. But we shall see who's right on this one. Matt Bukowiak, Republican strategist, or Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Take care.
The U.S. leads the world in COVID-19 cases with more than 6 million. But India today surpassed 5 million infections. And the virus continues to surge there. Its side effects are threatening many who aren't even getting sick. The BBC's Yogita LeMay joins us from Mumbai on Skype, and she's been visiting communities impacted by COVID-19. And Yogita, these numbers are staggering, but India is a huge country. Put what's happening in perspective. Is it as bad as it looks?
Well, I mean, if you look at the numbers we're seeing every day, sort of the new coronavirus cases that are being recorded, over the past week or 10 days, they're almost three times as many as you're seeing in the US. So that is the pace at which COVID is spreading here, faster than anywhere else in the world. Initially what we saw in the first few months, so I would say sort of March, April, June, the pandemic was sort of limited to big cities like Mumbai, where the health infrastructure is a lot better than remote parts of the country. Now what you're seeing is that there are surges in these cities, but you're also seeing surges coming from smaller towns, rural areas. And so now you have people coming to hospitals from smaller towns. So here in Mumbai, we are seeing hospitals saying that they are running out of intensive care beds. From the outskirts of the city, we've had lots of hospitals raising concerns that they are running out of oxygen supplies.
Hmm. There are tens of thousands of impoverished towns and villages in India. You've been out reporting. What are you seeing?
A lot of people in India do live sort of a hand-to-mouth existence. And what essentially COVID did, and this is not, it's not a direct effect in the sense that it wasn't these people weren't infected by COVID. But to stop the spread of COVID, India had quite a stringent lockdown. I think it was one of the most stringent in the world, imposed from April, May, June. And even after that, even since restrictions have been lifted, people have not sort of been as employed as they were earlier. They're not getting as much work as they used to. So, for example, in the northern city of Agra, you know, it's very famous for local artisans who make shoes. And, you know, they've been telling us that they've hardly had any work. You know, in fact, one man actually said that if it goes on like this, you know, the situation is so bad. He says that there was a time once when his family went hungry for four straight days. They say they're struggling for every morsel of food, and that if it continues like this, he says, you know, we'll have no option but to kill ourselves.
That is a powerful statement that shows just how desperate people are right now.
That's right. And that's also one of the reasons why imposing another lockdown to try to curb the spread of COVID-19 is not really under consideration at the moment, because, you know, people sort of living at the edge of hunger would be really pushed into it. You know, already economists that I've been speaking to say that over the past decade, India, you know, sort of made huge achievements by pulling millions out of poverty. And they say that, you know, all of those are at risk of coming undone right now. And that's why you see that despite the surge in cases, India continues to open up its economy. Metro rail systems in many cities have been reopened. Later this month, gatherings of up to 100 people will also be allowed. And the government is looking at, you know, figuring out operating procedures for schools and colleges so that they can allow those to reopen as well.
That's the BBC's Yogita LeMay. Thank you so much for giving us this update.
Thank you.
Schools around the country are operating at this point, but most are doing so remotely, with students logged into computers at home, often near their parents who are working from home. We've heard from teachers who are trying to do the best they can under the circumstances. But what about students? What is remote learning like for them? We're joined now by two students from two different districts in different states. Sixth grader Rebecca Gagne is a student at the Buffalo Academy of Science Charter School in New York. Rebecca, welcome. And also with us is Keitra Bippas, who's a senior at Flagstaff Arts and Leadership Academy in Arizona. Keitra, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you.
Well, and let me start with you, Keitra. You're a senior there. You're remote learning. Both of you are. How is it going so far to be learning remotely?
Especially compared to like in person, I feel like we're losing a lot of like hands-on learning and like I feel like we're going at a bit of a slower pace, but I do think that my school's adapted really well to the online learning environment and making sure it's not too stressful and that we're able to spend time away from the screen, even though we have to be on Zoom for all our classes.
And are you able to interact with your teacher as much as you would if you were there in person?
No, I'm not.
And what about with your classmates?
We basically just kind of like log on. I'm sitting in my kitchen usually, and then the teacher starts a lesson, and then they end the lesson, and then we just all leave. So we don't really get to talk to each other at all.
Mm-hmm. And Rebecca, what about you? You're in sixth grade. How is it going for you so far to be learning remotely?
Well, it's doing good. We sometimes get in late because it's hard to log on because Zoom sometimes doesn't let you in very well, but
Yeah,
I feel like we're losing some of the learning because we have 50 minutes for each class, but there's also a point where they're doing attendance and students are logging on.
And when you go from class to class, do you have to get out of that Zoom and start another Zoom, or do you stay on the same one all day long?
So, yeah, we go class to class, so we have different teachers, but we have 15 minutes on each class. But then when we log out of the Zoom, we usually have 5 to 10 minutes of like stretching, getting a snack, and then we have to log on to our next class.
Now, I will say, from an adult's perspective, it sometimes can be hard to stay focused when you're on Zooms all day long. How is it for you, Rebecca, in terms of just staying focused on what you're learning? Do you get bored watching the screen all day long?
I do. It's hard to stay focused, but so far I've managed to like not walk away from the screen or do that kind of thing.
And what about you, Keetra?
Our classes are only 40 minutes. And when we went online first in March, it was like an hour and 20 minutes for each class. So compared to that, it's a lot easier to stay focused, but I find it a lot harder to stay focused to do my homework. It feels kind of like I'm just like in class constantly. So it's a lot harder for me to focus on that.
And Keetra, what's your favorite subject at this point in the world of remote learning?
Probably English.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Rebecca?
I really like all the subjects, but I think if I would say my favorite, I think it would be art or music, but I also really do like English too.
How is it to be at home with your parents? And do either of you have siblings that are also around? Keetra, I'll start with you.
I actually have a little sister, so we actually go to the same school. And it's kind of hard adjusting to like having someone else like in class at the same time as you, and like hearing other people just kind of like moving around the house or like doing the dishes. It's kind of like hard to focus, especially if you're like during like a quiz or something. But my family's pretty good about being quiet, but it's a lot harder.
Rebecca, what about you? Do you have people at home with you also, and how has that been?
So my mom's an essential worker, so she's been out at her school, which is close to our house, so she's serving lunches out. My dad is upstairs in his office. I have a brother who's 14 months older than me, so he's in 7th grade. It is actually kind of distracting when he's shouting at the screen for something that only he can hear.
Do you ever shout at the screen?
No, not really. We usually mute our mics, so if I did, nobody would hear it. They would just see my mouth move.
And I imagine that it's difficult to be apart from all of your friends. Have you been able to stay connected with your friends?
Yeah. On Gmail, there's Hangouts. So if I want to talk to someone, I can just like add them on Hangouts, and we can have conversations whenever we want. So yeah, I stay connected with my close friends. Not like everyone in the class, but I have a few friends who, if I want to talk to them, I can talk to them whenever I want.
Keetra, have you been able to stay connected to your friends?
Yeah. So me and my friends, we usually just talk in like a text group chat. And I normally would just spend time like in class or during lunch talking to them. But now since it's basically like all like lesson time, I don't really have the chance to really catch up with other people. So it's just mainly my main group of friends that I have kept in touch with.
So let me just ask each of you, because, you know, we've had a lot of conversations about what's happening with school right now, with teachers and with superintendents and with parents. What about from your perspective, what would make it better for you given the pandemic and that, you know, until it's gone, things are going to have to be different? But what would make it better for you? I'll start with you, Keetra.
For me personally, it's my senior year, so I've been spending a lot of time working on like scholarship applications and college applications. And so a lot of the time, I feel like I would just have normally set up like an in-person, like maybe like an hour-long appointment with like my college counselor. But now I kind of have to send like a ton of emails to my counselors, and it just kind of takes a bit longer to get the answers that I need. So I don't know if there's necessarily anything that could be like done, but like I feel like just maybe like appointments that could be made with administration. But other than that, I think that my school's done the best that they could.
Rebecca, what about you? If the superintendent or the principal is listening right now, what would you say would make things easier for you?
So I have 4 classes each day. So every day my classes go to 1 o'clock. Clock, and I have to wait until like maybe 1:30 until I've got all my work done to go and have lunch. So what would make it better for me is if we had like a longer period of time than 10 minutes, so I'm not hungry throughout the whole period.
Let me just ask each of you, what has been the most difficult thing, school or not school, about the pandemic for you? What do you miss the most, Rebecca?
We had a lot of like family campfires or birthday parties or something, going bowling or like just family gatherings that my family and my cousins and everyone would get together, and then the kids would just like run around and stuff. So it's been hard to like stay distanced from my family when they live just like two blocks away.
And what about you, Keitra?
My family never really had like cookouts or anything, but like I miss being able to have like large groups of people and just like hanging out with people like downtown, and we like go around to shops, or like we would go do diving, so I would be able to like dive like three times a week. So I just really miss being able to like do things outside of my house.
Well, I hope that both of you are able to get back into school at least for a few days a week before the end of this year, especially you, Keitra, so that you can have a little bit more in-person learning before you graduate. That is Keitra Bippas, who is a senior at Flagstaff Arts and Leadership Academy in Arizona. And we've also been speaking with sixth grader Rebecca Gagneau, a student at the Buffalo Academy of Science Charter School in New York. Thank you so much to both of you, and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if you are a student listening to this, we'd love to hear from you so we can continue this conversation, especially if you're one of the few who is actually back in the physical classroom. Go to hereandnow.org and tell us how things are going.
Record wildfires are raging from California all the way up to Washington state, blanketing cities with smoke. At a press conference this week, Washington Governor Jay Inslee spoke about the impact of what he called climate fires on the state's air quality.
Preliminary data from our state's air quality monitors show that last week has produced more days of hazardous air quality than in any period since monitoring began in the early 2000s.
Because of the pandemic, that smoke is even more dangerous to public health than usual. And also because of the pandemic, cities aren't as prepared or as able to help residents shelter from the smoke. From member station KUOW in Seattle, Eilish O'Neill reports.
Elias Barrera lives with his wife and two daughters in an apartment complex in Auburn, a suburb south of Seattle. His younger daughter, Alexa, has always had respiratory problems. Barrera says, last time it was smoky in the Seattle area,
her nose was constipated all the time, coughing with phlegms. So when they're little, it's a little bit more complicated because they don't tell us exactly what they feel.
This is Alexa. She's 9 now.
Well, I don't know how to explain it. Like, it's like clogged.
Wildfire smoke is always bad for health. It can exacerbate asthma and other respiratory diseases, and it can contribute to long-term health problems like heart disease. But this year, experts are even more worried about the potential health consequences of smoky air. Joel Kaufman is a professor of public health at the University of Washington.
If we have bad air pollution, while COVID-19 is still widely circulating in our community, that could be a recipe for worse impacts than we have with either one alone.
A group of Canadian researchers found that a moderate wildfire smoke event could increase the impact of a coronavirus outbreak by about 10%. And experts say that what the West Coast is experiencing right now is worse than moderate. Kaufman, the University of Washington professor, says part of the reason that wildfire smoke could worsen the pandemic is that air pollution can alter people's immune responses and increase inflammation in their lungs and respiratory systems.
The part we're worried about, that air pollution exposures will worsen people's responses to the infection and cause COVID-19 infections to be worse.
And, Kaufman says, people recovering from COVID could be more vulnerable to the dangerous effects of air pollution. On top of that, because of the pandemic, there are fewer places for people to take refuge from the smoke. In normal years, you could escape to air-conditioned offices during the day. But lots of people are working from home now, and across the West, especially in temperate cities like Seattle, San Francisco, and Portland, most homes don't have air conditioning. Plus, Kaufman says the normal policy responses aren't possible this year.
One of the major public health interventions that we give for individuals who need to be protected from air pollution, the elderly, those with underlying heart and lung diseases, small children, particularly those with asthma, is to provide indoor areas, community centers, and so forth, as sort of refuges from the pollution.
But crowding strangers into public buildings isn't safe during a pandemic. In Seattle, public officials had planned to keep shelters closed, but the smoke got so bad that the city did open one 24-hour smoke shelter that can hold 100 people. Shirley Tan is with the City and County Public Health Agency.
So our advice this year is just try to stay home and then look into purchasing a portable air purifier.
Or, she says, people can clean and cool their homes using a box fan with a filter on the back.
And there's pretty good data showing that they're very effective at clearing the air in a short amount of time.
Still, that only works for people who have homes. For those who are unsheltered, Tan says two of Seattle's emergency shelters have air filtration already, two don't, and there's no plan to install anything.
So it's really a complicated season with very little capacity. We're stretched thin.
Some smaller Oregon cities, such as Eugene, opened daytime smoke shelters for anyone needing respite from the heat and smoke. San Francisco opened four libraries as smoke shelters and distributed hundreds of N95 masks to people living unsheltered. Back in the Seattle suburb of Auburn, Elias Barrera says he has a filter fan. He got it from a Seattle area public agency that's handing them out in low-income neighborhoods with poor air quality. Auburn's in a valley, so it often has worse air quality than the rest of the county. Barrera put his fan in the living room window to test out how it filters the air as it draws it into the apartment.
Turned this around. So this is it. So I have it here. The filter is...
Barrera showed me the fan over Zoom.
I don't know if the camera will catch it, but you can tell how the filter, it's getting a little darker. So that tells me that it's working.
Barrera says he'll be putting the fan in his daughter's bedroom soon to help her breathe a little easier until the smoke clears. For Here and Now, I'm Alicia Neal in Seattle.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
In a new movie, Susan Sarandon plays a matriarch with ALS who decides to gather her family together for one last holiday visit. We talk with her and the director of Blackbird. That's next time on Here and Now.